current state on 90.5 WKAR, Mid-Michigan's news destination. For the informed, the caring, and the curious, welcome back. Coming up on today's show, Michigan Democratic House Leader Tim Grimmel joins us in just a couple of minutes. We also learn more about General Motors' new female CEO, Mary Barra, and we update the Grand Ledge time capsule mystery. This will be fun. As if opening up a 100-year-old time capsule isn't mysterious enough on its own, this one includes a particular mystery that was completely unexpected, which might be part of the reason we enjoy time capsules so much, right? That's all coming up on Current State. At the top of our program, the Michigan legislature is in its final week of voting before it adjourns for the year. One of the big questions is whether lawmakers will cast votes on a controversial anti-abortion issue this year. The measure was put before the legislature by a petition drive that gathered 300,000 signatures. Current State has more from the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta.
This is shaping up as a rare act of defiance by the legislature, or at least its Republican leaders, when it comes to the anti-abortion lobby.
Hey, it's baffling to me.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican state Senate majority leader. Today, he's a policy advisor at a Lansing think tank. He says this delay in voting does not make political sense.
Clearly, a Republican Senate and a Republican House are going to take a vote on this initiated law, and I don't think there's any question about that, and the votes are there to pass it.
And that's because the legislature has commanding majorities aligned with the anti-abortion movement. A majority of lawmakers even signed the petitions to initiate a law. This law would require someone to buy a separate policy for abortion coverage. Insurance companies could not include that as part of a basic health plan. Governor Rick Snyder vetoed a similar measure last year because there were no exceptions to allow insurance to cover abortions in cases of rape or incest. An initiated law cannot be vetoed by a governor. If the legislature rejects the petition or doesn't vote at all, the question will go on the November 2014 ballot, but no one expects that to happen.
There will be a vote. We just haven't decided when that will be.
Amber McCann is the spokeswoman for State Senate Republican leader Randy Richardville. Richardville says he's in no hurry to vote on the measure, even if that pushes the issue into next year. But that would have consequences.
We want the law to be able to take effect in the new year. And if we wait till the new year and there's no immediate effect granted, then we wait all the way until 2015 before the law takes effect.
Ed Rivett is the chief lobbyist for Right to Life of Michigan. Let me explain what he's talking about. We know a majority of state legislators are on board with the petition, but there's the vote on that question, and then there's another procedural vote. It's called immediate effect, and two-thirds of the House and the Senate need to vote for immediate effect. That supermajority is not in the cards. What that means is if the vote happens this year, the law takes effect in about 3 months, or if the vote happens next year, the law would not go into effect until 2015. Abortion rights advocates would like to delay a vote long enough to force the question onto the November ballot. Megan Hodge-Groen is with Planned Parenthood.
We have a lot of folks that have been contacting us and really wanting to make sure that the legislature does not vote on this initiative, that it goes to the ballot.
But anti-abortion groups have geared up a campaign of phone calls and emails to urge lawmakers to act, preferably before the end of the year. And Ken Sikkema notes that Right to Life has a history of getting what it wants from the Michigan legislature.
Right to Life as an organization, it is very effective and very demanding.
And Right to Life is demanding votes this week from the legislature. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Rick Pluta at the State Capitol.
Well, as Rick Pluta just mentioned, the last day of the Michigan legislature's 2013 session is just about here. That has ramped up various efforts by majority Republicans to pass other proposals generating a lot of debate, not just the abortion insurance measure. Yesterday, for example, a measure increasing campaign contribution limits and three bills involving medical marijuana went from committees to the full House. Another measure would hold back Michigan's third graders if they're not reading up to their grade level. For his perspective here in the home stretch, we welcome Democratic House Minority Leader Tim Grimmel of Auburn Hills back to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you back. As we just heard, the GOP has the votes to pass this measure now. They're being pressed to pass it now. And yet there is a chance they may delay and thereby delay implementation. Tell us what you make of this.
Well, I think it's true that the Republican majorities in the State House and the State Senate have the votes to pass this proposal. That's because they're beholden to the special interest group that is Right to Life. But it's important to distinguish this issue from other issues in the pro-life, pro-choice debate. This proposal is an unprecedented interference in the private health insurance marketplace. It is so extreme that both Governor Engler and Governor Snyder vetoed similar proposals. And the reality is that it would prohibit insurance companies from covering abortion in their basic policies, even in cases of rape and incest, even in cases where a pregnant woman is facing an imminent miscarriage. It would, you know, allow procedures if a miscarriage is going on. But if a woman is about to miscarriage in the very near future, it would not allow a basic insurance policy to cover a medical procedure to end that pregnancy.
Let's and how much do the Republicans have to lose if they were to delay acting on the measure until next year?
Well, as Rick Pluta accurately pointed out, there are really two votes that have to be had. One is a vote on the proposal itself. The other is on this procedural question of immediate effect. And if it's passed this year without immediate effect, it would take effect in March of 2014. If it's passed next year without immediate effect, it would take effect in March of 2015. So unless they have the votes to get immediate effect, the timing of the vote matters immensely to the women of Michigan who stand to lose needed health insurance coverage.
Let's move on to campaign finance reform. The measure that emerged from the Ethics and Elections Committee yesterday allows for a doubling in several contribution limits and increases reporting requirements. Tell us more about that.
Well, this is a bill that takes our state in exactly the wrong direction. We need less money in politics, not more money in politics. We need more disclosure in politics, not less. This bill would do two things, both of which are very harmful to our political process. One is doubling the contribution limits, allowing more money into a political system that's already drowning in money. And it would also prevent Secretary of State Ruth Johnson from requiring disclosure of donors to soft money accounts, which, again, is exactly the wrong direction. We should be requiring more disclosure of who's donating to political efforts. We shouldn't be trying to cover up and prevent disclosure and transparency.
Some number of Republicans have a problem with this as well, too. Obviously, this issue in a way originated with the Secretary of State. What do you make of that split amongst the GOP there?
Well, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, to her great credit, came out and proposed requiring transparency, requiring disclosure. And within days, the Republicans in the state Senate put an additional provision in this bill that would prevent her from doing so. And the House Republicans seem to be going along with that. And so I commend Ruth Johnson for her courage to do the right thing. It's too bad that legislative Republicans are going in the opposite direction.
I also noted that there was an unsuccessful effort by Lansing's Andy Shore to increase disclosure of contributors to these issue ads yesterday, but that went down to defeat.
Well, unfortunately, that's true. Representative Shore had two amendments. One would require additional disclosure. The other would take out the proposal that's in the bill to increase contribution limits. And unfortunately, both of those proposed amendments were defeated on strict party line votes, with Republicans voting against them.
Now, on Monday here on Current State, Representative Lisa Postumus-Lyons, who chairs Ethics and Elections, called that proposal a nice compromise. Let's listen to part of that.
As we double the contribution limits in this bill, we're tripling reporting requirements. And as it relates specifically to issue ads, I was proud to offer an amendment that got adopted in committee that would require an entity paying for those issue ads to disclose themselves as the ones that paid for them. I think that's certainly fair while still protecting people's rights to free speech.
Care to respond, Tim?
Representative Lyon's amendment does essentially nothing. All it would require is that whatever political action committee or soft money, dark money entity is paying for an ad to say paid for by Citizens for a Better Michigan, but it would not require disclosure of who's contributing to that entity and who's behind that entity. So it's a smoke and mirrors proposal that does absolutely nothing to disclose who's providing the money for these issue ads.
And again, to get back to the Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson originally proposed identifying contributors to issue ads, and the governor supported that in his 2010 campaign, but Senate Republicans scuttled that, apparently on free speech grounds. The free speech argument obviously carries some weight with them. What do you make of that?
Well, the bottom line is, I certainly support free speech, too. We all support free speech. The issue here is not whether people will have the freedom to pay for ads that express their viewpoint. The question is, do they have to disclose publicly that they're doing so? And the people of our state have a right to know who is funneling money to political activity and political candidates. And legislative Republicans are trying to prevent that. I commend Republican Secretary of State Ruth Johnson for standing up and trying to do the right thing. I hope that Governor Snyder will abide by his 2010 campaign promise and veto this legislation if Republicans pass it out of the legislature.
We're talking with House Minority Leader Tim Grimmel. Representative Posthumous Lyons also says disclosure may pose a threat to contributors. She told our listeners that on Monday. I'd like to get your response to this. Here she is again from Monday.
You start disclosing these donors, and all of a sudden, there's targets on these people. You know, you go to a website, and it's an automatic hit list. We saw the IRS target specific donors to like a Tea Party organization. That's very real, and that's very possible should we enact what Ruth Johnson, what the Secretary of State, is asking us to do.
Care to respond to that, please?
Well, that's utter nonsense. Look, I have sympathy for a lot of people, but I don't have any sympathy for the big money, special interest contributors who are throwing money at legislators so that those legislators are beholden to them. Again, we need less money in politics and more disclosure, more transparency. A democracy is only as good as the freedom of information within that democracy. And voters have a right to know who's backing various candidates.
Procedurally now, what happens to the campaign finance measure?
The campaign finance measure is out of committee and is pending on the House floor. My understanding is that the legislative Republican leadership is trying to get 56 Republican members to support it. They've had some difficulty in that, but I think most people expect that they ultimately will persuade or cajole a majority of their caucus, 56 members of their caucus, to support it. I expect all Democrats to oppose it, just as all Democrats in the Senate opposed it, because we believe we need less money in politics and more disclosure.
But does it go back to the Senate, or what happens after the House is done with it?
It depends whether or not the proposal is amended in the House. If it is amended in the House such that it's different from the version passed by the Senate, then the new amended version will have to go back over to the Senate for the Senate's approval.
And the real question, if it were to pass, do you think the governor would sign it?
Well, I hope that he doesn't. I hope that he abides by his 2010 campaign promises. Unfortunately, what we've seen is that in the vast majority of instances, the governor has not had the backbone that many of us have hoped that he would have, and he has instead rolled over and gone along with whatever nonsense and unfortunate measures legislative Republicans pass out of the legislature.
Let's move on to these marijuana bills, which went to the full House yesterday. There are three of them altogether. The one appearing to generate the most attention is the pharmacy measure, which would allow licensed pharmacies to produce and sell medical marijuana. Supporters feel that would make the product more reliable. Where do Democrats like yourself tend to stand on that?
Well, I think we have diverse views in our caucus on it. My own view is that this proposal makes some sense, and I want to be clear that it would only allow pharmacies to do that if the federal government takes marijuana off of the Schedule I list of drugs, which are essentially prohibited under any circumstances, and moves it to Schedule II, which allows certain drugs, while heavily regulated, to be prescribed for medicinal purposes. And I think that if the federal government at some point does that, it makes perfect sense for Michigan to allow pharmacies to prescribe marijuana in a controlled, regulated form. It would take marijuana and marijuana distribution out of the shadows and make sure that the product that's sold for medicinal purposes is safe and well-regulated. And I think that's what people had in mind in the state when they voted overwhelmingly to allow medical marijuana.
It's interesting, though, because another of these three proposals would legalize dispensaries. A word we hadn't heard an awful lot of very recently, but it's back on the forefront again. Talk to us briefly about that and how that might interact with this pharmacy measure.
Well, I have mixed feelings about the dispensary bill. On the one hand, I don't think very many residents want a marijuana dispensary popping up in their neighborhood or next door. And so I think we have to be very careful about exactly what we're allowing and whether local municipalities are allowed to regulate the location and operation of these dispensaries. On the other hand, I understand the concern of those who say that until the federal government moves marijuana from a Schedule I to a Schedule II drug, there should be some means by which to distribute medical marijuana. And the dispensary bill, I think, is at least in part an attempt to allow a more formal distribution than is currently allowed under Michigan law. So I have very mixed feelings about it. I am studying the bill and looking at the details to see whether or not local municipalities will be allowed to properly regulate the location and operation of these dispensaries.
Are other members of your caucus as divided on this one as you are?
I think most members of my caucus support this bill. I don't think that support is universal, but I think most members support the bill.
And realistically, how many of these three could be passed by the House before the session wraps up?
Well, potentially all three of them could be. So we'll see what today and tomorrow brings, but it would not shock me if all three were passed by the legislature.
And where does your caucus stand on the two House education bills that include the so-called read or flunk bill, which would hold back third graders who lack reading proficiency?
Well, in regard to the two bills relating to third grade reading, one of the bills makes perfect sense. It provides some important measures and supports for elementary school children to make sure that they obtain reading proficiency by the third grade. The other bill is more controversial, the bill that would actually hold back third graders who do not reach reading proficiency. Nobody wants to see kids pass from grade to grade without having basic competencies in reading and other basic skills like writing and math. On the other hand, we believe that simply saying we're going to hold children back is not enough. We have to make sure that schools have the resources that they need to provide the supports, not just to hold students back, but to make sure that they're receiving the specialized instruction and support so that they are able to obtain reading skills and go on to be successful, productive adults.
What kind of day do you anticipate here for yourself? It sounds like there's an awful lot going on.
Well, there is a lot going on, and I expect that we'll have a long day today and a long day tomorrow, but there are a lot of important issues to discuss, and it's better that we take our time and really be thoughtful about the process and analyze these bills rather than rushing them through the legislature.
And tomorrow is it, right?
That's right. Our understanding is that, you know, the schedule is set by the House Speaker and the State House, but our understanding is that tomorrow will be the last day of session for the year based on what the House Speaker and the majority Republicans are telling us.
House Minority Leader Tim Grimmel of Auburn Hills, a very informative segment here. We really appreciate your time. Good luck. Happy holidays to
you. You too. Thanks for having me on the show, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Yesterday, General Motors announced Mary Barra would become the company's next CEO. Barra is the first female CEO of a major U.S. auto company. Here to tell us more about GM's new leader is Micheline Maynard, former New York Times Detroit bureau chief and editor of Curbing Cars. Mickey Maynard, welcome to Current State.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
What was Mary Barra's GM upbringing, briefly?
Basically, she's been at the company for her entire career, going all the way back to her undergraduate days at Kettering University, which is also known to some of us as General Motors Institute. She's never worked anywhere else, but she's worked in a variety of General Motors jobs, and actually I think her dad was a tool and die maker at GM, so she comes from a real GM background.
What are some of her most notable successes at GM?
Well, one of the interesting things that she did was in the 1990s, she was a top assistant to Jack Smith, who was the CEO, and Harry Pierce, who was vice chairman. And after General Motors had a very difficult strike in Flint in 1998, she was one of the people that came in to try to help GM fix its image afterwards, because they're pretty destructive to relationships with the UAW. She's run the Detroit Hamtramck Assembly Plant. She's been in charge of the Human Resources Department, and most recently, she was in charge of global product development, which is a very crucial job at the company.
Was her appointment expected, Mickey?
It was, to the extent that it was pretty clear that Dan Akerson, who's the outgoing CEO, had tapped her, I wouldn't say as a protege, but as his successor. Dan Akerson was one of the board members appointed by the Treasury after the $50 billion bailout, and it was very clear that he wouldn't be staying at GM forever, and he wanted to turn the company over to somebody from inside the company. GM had had two outside CEOs following Fritz Henderson and Rick Wagner, who were both let go by Treasury. I think he wanted to return the company to someone at General Motors.
Hmm. Who was her competition for this job?
I don't know if you would call it competition, but a couple of the other names that were mentioned were Steve Gursky, who was the Wall Street analyst who came on board at GM as a vice chairman and was in charge of the Opel turnaround in Europe, but the Opel turnaround just took a long time and still isn't accomplished. And then Mark Royce, who is the son of Lloyd Royce, who many people will remember as a GM executive, and he's been running North American operations. But I think one of the things that gave Mary a leg up was the fact that she'd worked in so many different parts of the company. Gursky had almost no GM experience before he came to the company. And while Mark Royce has some GM experience, he's younger, and there'll be time maybe down the road if he wants to stay with GM and eventually become CEO.
Beyond the fact that a major U.S. company is changing CEOs, this is big news because Barr is the first female to hold a CEO position at a major car company. Why is this happening now? Is there a reason this didn't happen 5 or 10 or 15 years ago?
No, the interesting thing about it is that while a lot of people are interpreting this as smashing the glass ceiling in Detroit, really women haven't had an easy time advancing at the car companies. You hear a lot of talk about, oh, it just needed time for the pipeline to fill up and eventually we'd have women in all kinds of crucial jobs. But in 1999, I did a story for USA Today on the women officers at the company. There were 14 in 1999, and if you fast forward to 2013, there are 14 in 2013. You're not really seeing more board members. You're not really seeing more women move up to key jobs. And I think the reason for that is that the auto industry is still very male-dominated, and a lot of talented women get offers to go to other types of industries and take them.
As noted, Barra has an engineering background. How does she compare to GM's previous CEOs, Dan Akerson and Ed Whitaker?
Well, they were both, Dan Akerson was an investment banker, basically ran a private investment firm. Ed Whitaker ran AT&T before he came to Detroit. He had no automotive experience. She's actually the first engineer since Bob Stempel ran the company briefly in the early 1990s. In the old days, and even in modern era, General Motors CEO is generally someone with a finance or staff background, where the president of the company, the chief operating officer, was an engineer. So the thing is, she hasn't actually engineered in a long time. So it'll be interesting to see how her engineering background helps her or whether her administrative background is more useful.
What about the perception of General Motors culture? Does this, I would assume this alters the perception of, I mean, GM's culture has been referred to, the word I read most often is hidebound. It's hidebound culture. Will the perception of its culture begin to change, and will the culture substantively begin to change?
I think this is a real shot in the arm for GM's image, because GM really took a beating after it went through bankruptcy and accepted the federal bailout money, and it got the nickname of Government Motors, and it was only on Monday when the Treasury Department sold the last piece of its General Motors stock. So the probably the best move they could have made coming out of that is to name someone refreshing as their CEO, someone unusual in Detroit as their CEO. As far as the culture, you know, you hear different things. I know Dan Akerson was frustrated by the slowness of change in General Motors, and he kept talking repeatedly about how General Motors' culture had to change and that he felt resistance to some of the things that he wanted to do. So it's going to bring up a good question. Can someone from the inside lead change when a change agent from the outside wasn't able to do so, or will GM people feel like, oh, good, one of ours is back. We can go back to the way we used to be. And that's going to be a big question in her tenure as CEO.
And what do you think is on her short list of challenges here at the end of 2013?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, first of all, GM is now a fully independent company. There are a lot of people who want raises, to be honest. When the government owned a big chunk of the company, there were restrictions on the kinds of raises and bonuses that GM people could give. So watch for action on compensation. I would also watch for action on product development, because in the last couple of years, GM has really started to focus on not just filling out its lineup time and time again, but developing some more distinctive new vehicles. And she says, though, that's going to be her mantra. I think she said no more crappy cars. And I think GM is trying to be more realistic about the competition instead of just saying, you know, we're GM and we're the best because we're the biggest. So I would say taking care of the people who work there plus General Motors product lineup will be a high atop her list.
Mickey Maynard is the editor of Curbing Cars. She's also a contributor to Forbes.com. Mickey, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. This week, we feature the East Lansing Rotary. Service above self is the long-held motto of Rotary International, a service organization with more than 34,000 chapters and over 1 million members worldwide. The East Lansing chapter counts around 80 members, whose ongoing projects include grants to the Relay for Life Cancer Charity Walk, Lions Club Summer Camps for Kids, and Weekend Survival Food Kits for Hungry Kids. And to tell us more, Current State welcomes two East Lansing Rotary, two ex-presidents of the East Lansing Rotary, John Saltzgaber and Tim McCaffrey. John's still a member, Tim's an ex-member, but still involved in one Rotary project in particular in his capacity as East Lansing Parks and Recreation Director. Tim and John, welcome to Current State.
Welcome, Mark. Good to see you.
There's a lot of nonprofits who'd love to have 80 or 90 people working on projects, John Saltzgaber. Remind our listeners how you recruit members and generally talk to us about how you operate.
Well, there's a variety of ways that we recruit members. The most frequent one is for a member to bring a prospect to one of our meetings. Mm-hmm. It might be a colleague from work. It might be a friend. It might be a business acquaintance. And bring that person either to one of our activities or to one of our weekly meetings where they might hear a speaker talk about a current topic of interest. And from that, if they're interested in learning more about our organization and how we serve the community and the types of projects we're involved in, obviously we want to engage them in a discussion about that. And if the interest continues, invite them to become a member of the club. Sometimes we even have folks come to our club meetings without an invitation. They may see a weekly notice.
They crash your meeting.
They do in the sense
I crash the Rotary meeting, yes.
in the sense that they might see a notice in the newspaper about what this program and the speaker is for that particular week.
I mentioned a number of initiatives that you're involved with at the top. Tell us about a couple of your more ambitious initiatives, Tim.
Well, right now, first of all, Mark, I am still a member of the Rotary Club.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
That's okay. That's fine. I've been a member of the club for 15 years and intend to stay for as long as I can. But one of our biggest projects, of course, is that the club is working in partnership with the city on right now is a Playground in the Park project. We call it the Playground in the Park Reimagined, where we're replacing the existing wooden playground structure in Patriarch Park with a new state-of-the-art playground structure. And the club has become very active in that project and agreed to spearhead the fundraising campaign for us. So all kinds of work is going into that project at this point in time.
And you've got a history with Patriarch Park. That goes really, the Rotary does, that goes back a few years.
We do, because back in 1995, we built that original structure there, the playground structure that is currently at the park that we're going to be replacing. And that's also been the site for the last 25 or 26 years for our annual Pancake in the Park breakfast that we have each June to raise funds for the various community projects that we help support every year.
There seems to be a focus on kids here with a lot. I mean, you've got the playground. You've got Lions Club summer camps for kids, weekend survival food kits for hungry kids. Is it fair to say that young people are a focus of your activities?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's, like you said, the playground structure, the playground project, and the club has sort of been real active now, and John's sort of leading the way with the club on this backpack project, and I think John could should talk to you more about that than
okay.
I can.
But.
We've got upwards of 10,000 kids just here in mid-Michigan that have some sort of food insecurity. That is that they're missing meals. And that's a big issue because if kids are hungry when they go to school, that's a real block to learning if they're worried about eating. So we've joined hands with several other service clubs and some churches and food pantries to supply food to kids, and we go to three elementary schools in East Lansing currently and are serving over 80 children, where every other week we take a pack of food to the school, and it generally goes in the child's locker to take home to help them get through the weekend in terms of food. But we're last year served about 1,200 kids of those 10,000. Our goal this year is to serve about 1,500.
We're talking with John Saltzgaber and Tim McCaffrey of the East Lansing Rotary. Tim, given your long history with Rotary, what project is most memorable for you?
Which project? I think the one that we're in right now, because this is a major undertaking for the club and for the city. You know, when it's all said and done, this project is going to be close to a $600,000 project. And we received a Department of Natural Resources Trust Fund grant through the City of East Lansing to get about $300,000 of the funds, and the club has already raised over $100,000, or close to $100,000 for the project. And we hope that we're going to have sufficient funds, and we're going to start the project actually probably next week with demolition of the existing park, and we will, of the existing playground structure, excuse me, and hopefully be under construction with the new playground in April, and we'll do another community build in June this year. So this is clearly the most memorable project.
Yeah. Can either of you recall a particular person or family that Rotary has assisted that stands out in your memory? I mean, do you get that close to the people that you serve?
I can't give you a specific name of a family, but another project that, or group that we've been heavily involved with has been Haven House, which is a shelter for homeless families. And over the last 15 years, we've been intimately involved with that organization. We helped to spearhead the funding to renovate their entire facility, to provide, you know, new bathrooms and new living quarters there. Just a couple of years ago, we helped raise $15,000 to replace the boiler at Haven House, which was a major expense. This past fall, we helped raise about $4,000 toward repairing the basement so it wouldn't leak there anymore. And for the last 5 years, we've partnered with different grocery stores. This year, Tom's Food Center in Okemos, to provide turkey dinners at Thanksgiving for the family staying at Haven House. And that helped feed about 35 folks, I think.
You mentioned the pancake event, which is a fundraiser for you. How else do you raise funds?
Well,
is that the central piece there?
That's the big one. Other than particular projects like the playground project, that's a separate effort. The money that we raise each year, it varies from year to year based upon participation, but it's generally $10,000 to $12,000 that we raise net out from the pancakes effort. And that goes to different community projects. It could be like a contribution to the high school for the prom night to help finance that. It could be to the Red Cross. We've donated to Ellie's Place. Different organizations approach us throughout the year, and it may be a small grant. It might be $250. It might be $1,000. But we're certainly open to receiving those and try to do our best to give back to the community.
And the Patriarch Park Playground now is on the verge of being dismantled. It may have already started to be dismantled, and you're asking for particular involvement from people who apparently have a kind of a souvenir from the park with people's names on them. Explain what's going on there.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, Mark, today is the second day that we're offering folks an opportunity to come retrieve their pickets. The current playground is surrounded by a fence, by a picket fence, and those pickets are each inscribed by the name of the donor who purchased that picket. So from 2:30 to 6 this afternoon, we're inviting the public to come back to Patriarch Park and retrieve their picket if they'd like. We're also encouraging folks to purchase a brick paver. And the new park will have an entryway with a pergola, and there'll be brick pavers set in that entryway and the sidewalks in that entryway. So it's another way for folks to create sort of a lasting memory, if you will, because this park is going to be built with materials that should stand up for 25 to 30 years. So we've got a couple different sizes of bricks. We've got a 4x8 at $100 and an 8x8 at $150 that we're encouraging folks, maybe as a Christmas present for a grandchild or a child, to purchase a brick and help us get the job done in terms of getting this park rebuilt.
Very good. You got a website that people can connect with you at, or is there a phone number you can share with us?
You can go to the City of East Lansing and then go to the Department of Parks and Recreation, and then you'll be able to find the playground in the park reimagined. Or you could just simply Google Playground in the Park, and it'll come up. I think it's like the second item that would come up on the Google page.
We've been talking with John Saltzgaber and Tim McCaffrey, both officials with the East Lansing Rotary, here on Neighbors in Action. John and Tim, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to see you, Mark.
Good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
We could always use more nominations for our Neighbors in Action segment, and we know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work. We need to know about them, though, so let us know. Please help us out. Send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org, put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Earlier this year, as part of its centennial celebration, members of the Trinity Episcopal Church in Grand Ledge removed a time capsule that had been placed in the cornerstone all the way back in 1912. Among the newspaper articles, photographs, and letters found in the capsule was a small package intended for the descendants of the Reverend J.E. Foote. The congregation has yet to identify any of Reverend Foote's relatives, and right now Clifford Nags, the church's senior warden, and junior warden John Bunday joined Current State to discuss this mystery. How are you?
Good morning. Very well.
Good morning. How are you?
Thank you for coming in. Let's start at the beginning here. Earlier this year, you opened a time capsule from 1912 that was placed in the cornerstone of the church. Tell us about that, and what did you find in there?
Well, in preparing for the centennial, we ran across a book in our library, which was entitled A History of the Western Diocese of Michigan. And in reading through there, we discovered a passage about the building of Trinity Episcopal Church in Grand Ledge, which referred to setting the cornerstone and referred to the time capsule. So that's how we knew it was there in the first place.
And did you discover that late, though? I mean, when did you discover that?
Oh, it was about a year or so ago. So we were aware of that and then planned to open that as part of our centennial celebration, which we did on Easter of this year, because Easter was the day that the church was officially consecrated by the bishop, then Bishop McCormick. And so our current bishop at the time, Bishop Gephardt, visited with us, and we had retained a building restoration company to come in and open the time capsule for us, which we did officially on Easter.
But I want to be clear about this. Did your congregation go some number of years not realizing there was a time capsule buried in the cornerstone of the church?
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was when you discovered this this item that you just mentioned that you realized you had one of those. Now you have this small package addressed to relatives of Reverend J.E. Foote. Who was Reverend J.E. Foote?
Well, Reverend Foote, as it turns out, is actually depicted in a picture of the groundbreaking of the church. He was a congregational minister in Grand Ledge at the time, and so the mystery was, what was the connection between a congregational minister and the Episcopal Church? As it turns out, his grandfather, Lumen Foote, was the first Episcopal priest in Charlotte, and so James E. was raised in the Episcopal tradition, made his way to Charlotte and became a congregational minister and was involved in that way.
What have you done to find the relatives?
Well, the first avenue was to talk to a reporter from the Grand Ledge Independent, and an article was published in the Grand Ledge Independent. A subsequent article was published in the Lansing State Journal. And from that point forward, it sort of went viral. It was about 2 weeks ago, I received a call from a reporter from the New York Daily News, and they had picked it up, I believe, on the internet, because we do have a Facebook site. And I was interviewed, Cliff was interviewed, and there was an article published in the New York Daily News on the mystery of finding the descendants of Reverend Foote.
Any luck? Any response?
Well, we may have a break. As it turns out, I received a call from, or I actually called, she had left a message, a Sandra Garrison from Charlotte, who is a relative through the Packard family from Charlotte. And she gave me the name of a Janet Foote, who lives outside of Houston, Texas, who we've talked to. And it appears as though she's a fourth generation Foote, a direct descendant from the Reverend J.E. Foote. So we think we're on to something.
And when will you know more?
Well, we're corresponding with Janet, and we'd like to have her come to Michigan and present her with this package and open it so we can see what's inside. I mean, there's speculation. It's likely letters and photographs. Who knows? There's jokingly saying there's a treasure map, or who knows what's in it. But she's very, very excited about it.
But it appears to be papers. It appears to be.
Okay. Yes. It's about the size of a large envelope that's wrapped up in paper and tied with string and inscribed in the hand of an old inkwell pen.
Right.
We'll have a photo of that package, by the way, on the Current State website at WKAR.org here before too much longer. What's the timeline here then? Have you made plans to invite Ms. Foote to Grand Ledge?
Well, we're still in conversation with her. She said she would prefer not to travel in the winter, so it may be spring or so before we're able to get her to Grand Ledge and have a service and ceremony to actually present it, and hopefully she can bring some of her relatives in as well. So it ought to be very exciting.
Now, what else was in the time capsule that really grabbed your attention, John?
Well, the probably the most interesting thing, or one of the most interesting things, was a 1700s Book of Common Prayer, which probably is quite valuable. And we did, in fact, return that to the new time capsule, which was recently interred in the cornerstone. There were numerous photographs, numerous postcards, newspapers, a farmer's almanac, and we did include a 1914 farmer's almanac in the new package. We replaced, I would say, probably 75% of the items that were in the time capsule when we found it, and replaced those in the new time capsule. And then with the other items have been donated to the Grand Ledge Historical Society, along with the original copper box that was opened. That box was sheet copper. It was very carefully soldered shut, and in order to get into the time capsule, had to destroy the box, or at least cut it open with tin shears, and that will be also on display at the Grand Ledge Historical Society. So some of the new things that we put in it, as I said, were the Farmer's Almanac, 1914 edition, a parish picture, a current prayer book, prayer book actually right out of the pews of the church, a number of articles. One of the articles that was in the time capsule that was really, really interesting was an in-depth article on the sinking of the Titanic.
Hmm.
And, of course, that would have been a really big deal
point
in time.
1912.
So there was some really interesting pictures of the Titanic. And so we put some information on the 9/11 incident that happened in New York City.
Oh, cool.
Which
okay.
was a big incident in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. How many members in your congregation, Cliff, and how did they respond when they found out there was a time capsule buried in the cornerstone of
Well, everyone church? Was really excited about it, as you might expect. We have about 40 what we would call pledging units, families, that are regular attendees, but there are a number of families in the Grand Ledge area that call Trinity their home as well. And it's been a very exciting time.
It sounds like a dramatic moment. I mean, the moment you actually punctured the box and started pulling things. Who had the honors of actually pulling things out of the time capsule?
Well, I had the honors of opening the box. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
I'm sure.
The thing that impressed me was the care and the craftsmanship of the box, the way it was sealed, And I really felt connected to the whole process of putting the box in the crypt, which is in the cornerstone. I really felt connected to the person who made the box, and of course reinforced my 53-year-old tenure of connection to Trinity. Trinity Church.
Were the materials well preserved?
Yes, yeah. Very well preserved.
Surprisingly so. They were all wrapped in paper and tied with string, and the copper box did the trick. I mean, there was no water damage, nothing.
Now, I suppose one of the challenges here, as you found out, is making sure that generation after generation after generation remembers that there's a time capsule buried in the cornerstone of the church. Are you taking any kind of measures to make sure that happens?
We indeed are. The first measure, of course, is the Grand Lakes Historical Society. And they have been actively involved in the process right from the very beginning. The second item that we are doing is making an entry in the Eaton County Registrar of Deeds. And the third, and I think most important, is the fact that there is indeed a international time capsule registry at Oglethorpe University in Atlanta.
Hmm.
And they, some of the information that I have gathered on time capsules is that they say there probably are 10,000 lost time capsules in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks at Oglethorpe are attempting to create an international clearinghouse of where time capsules are located and when they were placed. So our future plan, in fact, immediate future, is to register that with Oglethorpe University.
Very good. Very interesting stuff. And you can don't forget the smartphone angle. Just, you know, set an alarm on your smartphone for 2113. Well, we want to thank both of you. Clifford Nags is Trinity Episcopal Church's senior warden. John Bunday is the junior warden. We've been talking about their time capsule. John and Clifford, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, Right to Work, 1 year later. We also take a look at Launched, a startup contest celebrating entrepreneurialism in mid-Michigan. That and more Thursday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.